Cap Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's a busy time in California politics, with state lawmakers and Governor Gavin Newsom taking steps to rename tomorrow's holiday from Cesar Chavez Day to Farm Workers Day, following a damning investigation by the New York Times, to waves of people turning out across the state and the country this weekend in the latest round of No Kings protests against the Trump administration. And there is a crowded race for California's next governor, with a Democratic field that still isn't settling out, and a Republican candidate launching an investigation into ballots. Joining us now to get up to speed with these latest developments is Dustin Gardner, co-author of Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back, Dustin.
Hey, Vicky. Good to be back with you.
Okay, well, let's start off with this weekend. This past Saturday saw millions of people take to the streets across the country for the latest round of No Kings protests. How did that play out across California?
I mean, once again, we just saw huge turnouts in the major cities across the state, you know, places like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Oakland, but even the battleground areas of the state, places like Riverside County, Orange County. And I think, you know, this really just speaks to Democrats feeling increasingly good about the midterm elections coming up in November. I think Democrats, you know, looking at the size of these crowds, people like Nancy Pelosi, in their public comments, they're being pretty, you know, pretty bold in saying that they're confident Democrats can retake the House, and they think even possibly the Senate. And the turnout at these types of rallies really is just fueling that optimism from the Democratic side.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, these protests are pushing back on the Trump administration. Governor Gavin Newsom, of course, has been a vocal critic of the president and his policies. But from your perspective, since you cover this so closely, how have state lawmakers at the Capitol been acting or even framing the state's role against the Trump administration?
I think even more so this year than last year's legislative session, we're seeing Democrats really lean into that Trump resistance idea. There's more bills dealing with things like accountability for ICE and limitations on federal immigration raids in the state. And just overall, we're seeing a lot more legislation in that vein of Trump resistance and, you know, casting California as a leader of that resistance. I think during the first year of the second Trump presidency, we saw legislative leaders kind of try to set a tone that they wanted to be focused on affordability and some of the state's most pressing challenges. And those things are still a focus for them, of course. But I think we're seeing the Trump resistance be much more of a focal point this legislative session.
Okay, so moving from this weekend to tomorrow, state lawmakers passed, Governor Newsom signed legislation to rename Cesar Chavez Day, a state holiday, to Farm Workers Day. And that's following that investigation by the New York Times that uncovered multiple allegations of sexual abuse and assault against the former labor leader. How have lawmakers been framing this name change?
The revelations about Chavez were just really devastating for a lot of Democrats. And, you know, many legislators have come out of the labor movement or they're very close to the labor movement and have a lot of friends and allies. And I think it was, you know, it's been a lot of processing for them dealing with these revelations that, you know, that Chavez, an icon of the labor movement and the farm worker movement and the civil rights movement in California, you know, these allegations of abuse. And so I think the framing that I'm seeing from a lot of legislators is this notion that the movement was never just about one person. And, you know, this pivot to instead of Chavez Day, Farm Worker Day, that sailed through the legislature very quickly. And lawmakers voted last Thursday and Governor Newsom instantly signed it. And I think it's really with all of those parties getting on board with this idea that they want to preserve the legacy of those movements and really promote this idea that it was never just about one person. So I'm hearing a lot of that in recent days. And, you know, the holiday was renaming the statewide holiday was really the first piece of this. But there's so many places, you know, streets, libraries, schools, public places throughout California that still bear Chavez's name. And so I think this is really just the start of what's probably going to be a years long effort to start renaming a lot of those public places.
Yeah, I mean, the city of Sacramento is among many places that are now considering to rename Cesar Chavez Plaza. There's so many places and buildings that have his name. He also is part of California's school curriculum. I mean, do you know if that will be stripped out?
I have not seen discussions or debates around that play out in the legislature yet. I think, a lot of that sort of discussion is probably kind of happening behind the scenes as the state debates, whether, the State Department of Public Instruction, the school superintendent, whether they should lead in that debate. And like I said earlier, I think a lot of Democrats have been processing just how exactly to deal with this information. It was such a bombshell report from the New York Times that it's taken a while for some of these other pieces to come to the surface. The holiday was really the most obvious thing they had to deal with. I mean, it's, March 31st, tomorrow is the day. And I think had they not dealt with that piece, it would have been a pretty tough look for the state to have his name on a paid holiday. So I think in time, there'll probably be more debate around the curriculum and the place names, like I was talking about.
Remind us how deep Chavez's connections, but also the roots of the labor movement run in state politics.
I mean, he really is the most iconic labor leader, civil rights leader in California history. Him and, Chavez and Dolores Huerta are really, the two people that birthed a lot of the modern labor movement that took hold in statewide, especially in the Los Angeles area, the Central Valley. The two of them are the pioneers of so much of that organizing, and they've been the iconic, revered figures to so many in the labor movement. And, I've had conversations with labor leaders in San Francisco and other places, and it's taken a lot of, self-reflection for them to absorb this information. It was a hit to a lot of people that spent their whole lives and careers idolizing this person, and now, they're really discussing the hard fact that that's a lot of pressure to, and weight to put on one person's reputation. It really was a movement of many people, not just one man, and I think that's a lot of the message I'm hearing.
And as you and your colleagues have reported, this reckoning will come in stages. Let's turn now to the governor's race, because there's a lot, of course, understandably, happening with the gubernatorial race. Riverside County Sheriff, Republican candidate Chad Bianco, he recently seized more than 500,000 ballots from last November's election, which saw voters pass Prop 50 for redistricting as part of an investigation. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Sheriff Bianco has said that he suspects there are some irregularities in the last November special election to redraw the state's congressional district map. But he's really provided no evidence to say what irregularities he's concerned about. And this is what has Democrats in the legislature and State Attorney General Rob Bonta very worried about this. They say this is an unprecedented move to have a local sheriff seize this incredible amount of ballots. I think we're talking now over 650,000 ballots. And so I think a lot of people are waiting to see what Bianco can point to justify why he made this sort of an unprecedented move. But we also have to remember that this comes in the context of a political campaign. Chad Bianco is running for governor, and he's doing pretty well in the polls, as Tim and Steve Hilton, the other Republican in the race. They're doing very well because there is such a crowded Democratic side of the field, and that has allowed them to do better in the polls. So I think a lot of people are interpreting Bianco's move in seizing these ballots as an attempt to get President Donald Trump's attention and an attempt to try to draw him into the race and maybe court his support. And it's also an attempt to, by Bianco, to shore up his own support among Republicans. Steve Hilton has been eclipsing Bianco in some recent polls. This seems like a way for Bianco to get more attention on the right as he tries to make sure he's the Republican that could potentially get through the primary.
Has Trump endorsed a Republican candidate?
He has not endorsed either candidate. He hasn't waded into the race at all. Both Hilton and Bianco say a lot of nice things about Trump, and they've both made efforts to court the president and people in his orbit. So I think we'll be watching pretty closely in the next 2 months or so before the primary to see if Trump really does wade in. And if he doesn't wade in, he might be looking at some of the polling that suggests there is a slim chance of two Republicans potentially getting through the June 2nd primary. And that would probably be the ideal outcome for Trump and Republicans if there was a total, lockout for Democrats. As unlikely as that might be, that's, another potential scenario.
I mean, you mentioned that a move like this from Sheriff Bianco is pretty unprecedented. I mean, he's did this seizure in his capacity as sheriff, but of course, he's also a candidate for governor. I mean, what are the potential larger impacts of being able to do something like this?
I think that's the precedent that Attorney General Rob Bonta and others are really pointing to, is saying that if someone is allowed to seize such a large number of ballots, a local law enforcement official, without showing strong probable cause, that it sets this dangerous precedent of potentially, you know, other local officials trying to do something like this in the future, maybe for political reasons. That's the concern I'm hearing from Democrats. And Bonta's gone as far as saying that he questions whether Bianco really was able to demonstrate probable cause when he got two warrants to pursue this. And the judge that that approved those warrants is a conservative judge who's had some pretty favorable things to say about Bianco in the past. And so I think a lot of folks are looking at that context, and Democrats are questioning whether there was really proper justification. And really, we're all waiting to see what evidence the sheriff has to show for taking such an unprecedented step.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Politico's Dustin Gardner about the latest in state politics. So this is the time, of course, where there typically are debates. And it is kind of tough when you have 10 leading candidates, 8 Democrats, 2 Republicans, getting them all on the stage. And we saw this difficulty come to life last week at the governor's debate that was scheduled to be held at USC last Tuesday in Los Angeles, but it was canceled last minute after the selection criteria was criticized for leaving some candidates off the stage, all of the candidates of color. Politico spoke with the professor that created the formula choosing which candidates could participate. So what happened there?
It was quite a mess leading up to this cancellation. The candidates that had not been initially included in the debate, they had been raising complaints for about 2 weeks, you know, questioning the criteria. And Christian Gross, the USC professor, political science professor, he created this formula that assigned all the candidates a viability score based on how they performed in a recent poll and their fundraising. And because some candidates have done much better in terms of their recent fundraising, it allowed a few people to score much more highly based heavily on their fundraising. For example, San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan was polling at around 3% in the poll that was used for this analysis, and he was allowed to participate in the debate, even though folks like Javier Becerra and Antonio Villaraigosa had polled better than him recently. They did not make the cut because their fundraising had not been as strong recently. And so this led to a whole flurry of allegations that this formula was biased, and the candidates that weren't being included on the debate stage happened to be the candidates of color. And so that just led to a lot of consternation in the field. And Professor Gross, he defended this criteria, saying it was objective, it was formulated. He came up with the formula before there was any recent polling or fundraising numbers. He really stood by that, and USC stood by that until the night before the debate was supposed to happen. At the last minute, the university announced this cancellation that just, you know, really jarred all of the campaigns. And it just, you know, it just speaks to the difficulty of having such a large field. You have 8 well-known Democrats still in this race, 2 Republicans, and it is very difficult to organize a debate with that many people. But ultimately, I think USC just did not want to take the heat that they were facing from so many different sectors of the party, especially, Democratic leaders in the legislature, for example. It's a very, very unusual drama and a lot of accusations flying.
Yeah, I mean, you've been talking to us about this since the beginning of the year, having a crowded race for governor when it comes to Democratic candidates. And from the very beginning, there was, you know, this off chance that because California is a top 2 state, it could end up being 2 Republicans that make it to the general election, because having so many Democratic candidates, you know, just thins the vote out. And as we keep having you on and this continues to develop, that far off possibility seems to be more and more of a concern among the Democratic Party. What does polling look like today?
Yeah, I mean, the polling, it hasn't changed a lot in the last 3 months. You still have Eric Swalwell, Katie Porter, and Tom Steyer. They're the top three Democrats, and they've been, statistically tied in most of the polls. Swalwell's done a little bit better in some recent surveys. And then you have Republicans Steve Hilton and Chad Bianco continuing to do very well because the Democrat in the polling because the Democratic field is so splintered. Hilton has tended to lead in several of the more recent polls. So yeah, I mean, the race is the fundamentals of the race in terms of just sheer polling seem to be pretty similar to where they were at the start of the year. And so I think Democrats who were sort of laughing off or brushing off this idea of two Republicans getting through the primary and locking Democrats out, they've had to recognize that that is a much more realistic possibility as the dynamics of the race haven't changed as quickly as folks anticipated. And I think that's part of the frustration with a lot of campaign folks that were upset about the canceled debate is that, you want those types of moments. You want a debate where, maybe one of the Democrats could emerge and by canceling debates and, not having those moments, it was, kind of counterproductive to what a lot of party leaders were hoping to see.
But even looking at like this a recent poll, like, and as you mentioned, like Steve Hilton, Chad Bianco, both Republicans are in the lead, but they're clocking like 16%, 14%. And then there is that statistical tie between Democrats, Eric Swalwell, Katie Porter, and Tom Steyer at 10%. All of those percentages feel kind of low, even for the two that are in the lead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, with that many candidates, even if someone has, been running a pretty strong campaign, spending a lot of money, it's just hard with that many well-known candidates for one of the Democrats to start breaking, into the higher double digits, getting over 20%. And a lot of political insiders anticipate that for someone to get through the June primary and advance to November, they need to capture more than 20% of the vote, somewhere maybe in the mid 20%. And it's just really tough with eight well-known Democrats for anyone to get there. And I think party leaders and voters are just going to be getting more and more frustrated if some of the candidates don't drop out because the math is just tough unless someone has a really, really breakout moment.
Yeah, and just over a month before ballots get sent out in the mail. Dustin, as always, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Dustin Gardner is the co-author of Politico's California Playbook, getting us up to speed on all the latest developments in state politics. Up next, when confronted with a life-altering decision, the path ahead can feel pretty uncertain, paralyzed by wanting to make the right choice. We'll learn about a framework to stop overthinking and to start choosing with confidence. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.